There we go.
So welcome, everyone. This is great to see so many people here tonight. Just to let you know, we have two more weeks today and next week in this book, Mindfulness in Action. So if you're new and you don't have the book, no problem to be in here and listen to the class and participate. But we're finding this an amazing book, so you might want to get it. And, of course, all our talks are online. And we started this sort of the end of January, I think. So today we're on Class 11, which is amazing. And what I said is next week will be the last week. And then, just to let you know, the following week, which will be April 14th, will be a movie. We're going to show a movie called Live and Become. And did you put that on the web yet?
It's on the web. I forgot to get the colored posters to put around the church.
Oh, right. You didn't bring
it. But it is an amazing movie. We're going to start right at 7. We're going to have only chairs because we're going to set out 60 chairs. And we're going to start the movie and show it right through, which would probably be till about 9:20 or so.
So there'll be more on the website about the movie itself.
No meditation.
There won't be any sitting practice then.
You could not listen to the movie.
So tonight we're covering two chapters, The Fringe of Emotions, Chapter 20, and Chapter 21, The Heart of Emotion. So these chapters actually work well together. And as I was thinking about the bigger view of this, I realized that the first chapter, The Fringe of Emotions, kind of starts further out, like on the edge, and we work towards the center, which is the heart of emotion, the second chapter. So the beginning of this book is, the beginning of this chapter is really a discussion of ego. We keep coming back to our favorite topic, ego and ego's projections. And then it's more about lightening up ego and opening up through awareness to nowness and totality and space. So from that point, we move further into the heart of emotions. So I thought we could start by getting a volunteer to read the first paragraph in The Fringe of Emotions. This is there's so much here. I practically underlined every sentence, as Erica has said before.
Yeah,
it's hard not to star and underline things, and they do keep popping out. So would someone like to read the first paragraph in the book? Oh,
sure.
Thank you.
And this is The Fringe of Our Emotions?
Yes, okay. The Fringe of Our Emotions.
In this chapter, we're going to talk about how to work with our emotions from both a narrow egotistical point of view and from a more open perspective. The characterization of ego here basically highlights its confused and self-centered side. As we've seen in the previous chapter, when we are trying to maintain the illusion of a fixed, permanent self or ego, we occupy ourselves by constantly looking for new ways to prove the validity of its existence. One of our most powerful strategies is our involvement with emotional projections. We use aggression, passion, ignorance, and other confused manifestations of our emotions as ways to maintain our storylines about ourselves.
Thank you. That says a lot right there. There's a tremendous amount in there. So we're starting here with the discussion about ego and the self-centered quality of ego. And then how ego is trying to maintain this illusion of a fixed, permanent self. And then it says how ego is constantly looking for new ways to prove the validity of its existence. And one of those ways is the strategy of emotional projections. So from the point of view of this solidification of ego, it requires also these projections outward on other people and these stories that we tell. So I just keep flashing back on experience I had in 3-year retreat, which was, it's a very closed situation. You can't leave or do anything. And you start to, the people around you just drive you crazy because those are the only people you see for a long time. And I think there were 5 women on the women's side and 5 men. 3 people dropped out before it started on each side. I just remember how I would just get this thing about this one person, and just totally driving me crazy because I wanted to be busy and do things, and she basically worked from the other point of view, which was just do nothing and relax. And it was just driving me absolutely insane because I felt she wasn't doing her share, she wasn't participating. So I realized this ego, this projection got bigger and bigger and bigger. And in retreat, there's nothing you can do. And most of it's silence, so you can't actually attack anyone or say anything. Or, you know, and all you do is see what's happening in your mind. And believe me, that is painful. So I just kept thinking about this when this whole section on projections. And if we start looking, we're doing this all the time, how we look at people, how we judge their clothes, how we solidify from our view and project outward. And there's a sense of then these emotions really carry us away, passion, aggression, and ignorance. And before we started, I was talking with Jeff, and he said he was going back to look at the talks. I think they're from a year ago in the fall. And that was teachings by Punlop Rinpoche, that module, and it was about working with emotions. So you might, if you want to go back and look at those, or if you're new, that's a very good place to start. Plus there's a text online that I actually typed out. That was the only way I could really get it on there. So there's some good material there if you want to go into this a little more. But this particular chapter, I think, comes at it in a very, very interesting way. Because what jumped out at me was the way it was described, that the emotions, how the emotions flourished through kind of the thought and the emotions. This page, on page 139, I think this section is really amazing. When we are filled with emotion, it seems that something quite exciting is happening, and that there is a substantial entity at the center of the activity. When ego co-opts the emotions in this way, they function like the limbs of ego's enlarged mental body, extending its reach and reinforcing its hold. Attaching the thought process to the emotions is the key here. Thoughts are employed as the veins and arteries that circulate the blood of ego through the limbs. Thoughts also function as the nervous system that carries impulsive messages back and forth from the limbs to central headquarters, the apparent heart and brain of ego. To me, this is such a visual image of how the whole system works. And this is what I like about this chapter. It says that there is the thoughts basically keep things going, and the emotions are what really keep... It intensifies the whole thing. So the emotions and keeping this entertainment happening through the emotions is a whole system of how we solidify ego and how we keep going. Is there any comments here or anything that you noticed in this part in the beginning?
Right at the second paragraph, I noticed the word... No, it wasn't the first paragraph, what it said, wasn't it?
I'm again on page 139. Mm-hmm. I love the sentence, ego's scheme is to appear constantly vulnerable to attack. You know, it's like...
Where is that on the page?
It's the middle of the last paragraph.
Yeah, middle of the last paragraph on 139.
Okay.
It starts with, once this system is well established, then when there is an absence of emotional upheaval, ego generates its own dramas. So that even within a relatively calm state, fundamental panic and feelings of irritation and paranoia are generated, which cause us to initiate self-protective mechanisms. Ego's scheme is to appear constantly vulnerable to attack.
That is so amazing. Does that ring true to people?
Yes.
Hopeless. Why does it seem hopeless?
I guess I think it is hopeless. I mean, we're not
to do what?
Fix ourselves. Uh-huh. We'll always be that way, I think.
I don't think it's a matter of fixing. I mean, that's really important to... I mean, I hope that was said almost in jest, because there's no fixing possible or necessary. That we're just learning our own system here. It isn't like... There's a fundamental problem.
But there is fixing to some extent.
Certainly sounds.
No, it is hopeless because it's fundamentally. It's fundamentally.
It doesn't work.
Rotten, corrupt.
It's okay.
Yes, but this fix yourself project is what I'm commenting on. Is what I'm responding to. Is your
I understand that, but the way it's described, I mean, it certainly sounds it's not flattering stuff.
But that's good news. The moment you see it, that's fixing it. I mean, the way I read it is that, you know, essentially the external circumstances don't matter. And it's one of the observations I have is that my friends who are working and my friends who are early retired have the same level of stress. And that the stress comes from different things. Right. But that I don't know anybody who managed to make a life transition or a geographical cure that made everything calm. It's like the level of stress is the same, but the reference change.
Yeah, it's like wherever you go, there you are.
So that the emotional, what I love here is that it's really pinpoints the emotions as like the driver of the engine. It's like the engine that's sort of keeping the whole thing going.
Can I just comment?
Yeah.
I just don't want us to miss.
Yes, don't want to miss
this
anything.
One sentence. Yeah, I know. Attaching the thought process. Yes. To the emotions is the key here. Mm-hmm. So emotions kind of, it's part of the soup. They arise. Yeah. But as soon as they come up, we find a reason to solidify them, believe in them, and then
expand them.
Expand them, react.
And hold on,
create war.
Exactly. There's the skandhas all in its glory.
I had one specific experience when meditating. I told this to Emily, but I think it's relevant here, where I sat down irritated, which has a tendency to be the case, and I was really irritated about something that was going on in my current life, and I was trying to put that aside, and then I was sitting for a while and drifted, and I realized that I was sitting there being irritated at something my ex-husband did approximately 25 years ago. And it was a really interesting moment for me, because I realized I retained the emotion, and it was like the emotion, you know, a little bit, the mind calmed down, the emotion was still there, it reached out for something.
Yes.
And it wasn't even a particularly important fight among the many we had. You know, it was just like the one that my mind grabbed. It was like...
It was the container off the shelf.
Yeah, but I had not missed, because I was sitting, I had felt this, I had missed the change from the present day to 25 years ago. And it was really, you know, that I don't have that level of insight that often, but I can at least retain that as an example.
And that is the, you said when I was sitting, and that's really important too, because it's the process of meditation that we begin to see the pattern. Mm-hmm. And we are doing nothing when we're sitting there. And it's interesting how the emotion can be extremely entertaining and how we can easily drift off into, you know, 25 years ago and get, you know, hot under the collar of something that who cares at this point. But it's entertaining. And what fundamentally is happening is we are reinforcing ego every time we go that down that road. We are putting down another track in the ego train. So the power of meditation is actually to interrupt that process. And because meditation, we're working with thoughts, and we talk about emotions as being thoughts with kind of extra energy, you could say, but we level the playing field. We level everything because by not judging or like clinging, like saying one thing's more important than another, whatever comes up in the mind, it's just thinking. And that kind of global approach, and simple, it's very simple, that approach. The simplicity of the approach is what undercuts the power of ego. Does that make sense? And sometimes we want more, well, we always want more entertainment. So we may actually invent our own techniques, or we may try to exaggerate something, or have, you know, I call them add-ons. We want to sprinkle on, you know, the flavor enhancer, whatever it is. But really, what we're told is that the process of meditation is one of simplicity. And because the technique is so simple, there's really no place to go with it. And we start to see really clearly how we are always trying to do the add-on thing, add-on, add-on. So I think that's really powerful. Would someone like to read on page 140, the first paragraph? It's about meditation process and undercutting the circulation system. Over there. Jim?
Where are you?
Oh, on page 140, on the top page of the page, meditation, that paragraph.
Okay. I'll see if my arms are long enough.
Oh, you need glasses. Can you read it, or you want someone else to read it?
I think I can get through it.
Okay.
Meditation is a powerful tool to work this pattern of projection, to cut through the efficient work of ego and dismantle the barriers it throws up to protect its central headquarters. We begin working on the circulatory and the nervous system of the ego, that is, by working on the thought process. The complications and confusion of our thought process are there to ensure the ego's extremities, the conflicting emotions, remain securely connected to the ego's heart and brain. If the efficiency of the system is disrupted and set into chaos, then it becomes easier to work directly on dismantling the fundamental structure of our egotism. By applying mindfulness, the basic technique of meditation, we bring the existing thought patterns into simple situation as opposed to complicated one that the ego has constructed. Practice we already have, the practice of meditation undercuts ego's circulation system, its manipulation of thought process. We do this by relating simply to posture, breathing, and labeling our thoughts.
So it's so simple.
But the word disruptive there is very key. Mm-hmm. The simple technique of doing nothing is totally disruptive to the way we normally keep ourselves comfortable, and brings up lots of stuff.
So the first part of this, in the very beginning, it said that the fringe of our emotions is talking about two parts, how to work with emotions from a narrow egotistical point of view, which we've been discussing, and then the more open perspective, which begins on page 141. Does anyone remember what this more open perspective is?
Vipassana?
Yes. Very good. Do you want to say a little bit about what that is and why it's more open?
Well, I know with shamatha, which is the more focused form of meditation, that even though we have, I mean, just physically, is that okay if I...
Mm-hmm.
Physically, keeping the eyes open but having it on a downward focus, and still focusing in on, you know, all three, the body, the breath, the mind, watching thoughts, labeling, and come and go. But then with Vipassana, that the gaze is actually up. And there's an openness even sometimes on the sensory level in terms of watching thoughts, but also being allowing what comes into your sight, but also in your ears, and the whole senses get awakened. That's mm-hmm. one thing just physically that I can think of in terms of the difference between the two. And I know that with Chanyam Trungpa, that, you know, the focus is on the out breath.
Mm-hmm.
Which is kind of a, there's a generosity in my mind with that.
Mm-hmm.
That it's not actually, it's not cutting off, even in shamatha, I find in this practice, it's not cutting off or shutting down. It's actually letting in and allowing it to move through you. And,
so there's more openness and panoramic awareness.
I felt like this paragraph on 142, sort of where he talks about what's the difference between sort of mindfulness and awareness. Because I kept reading that going, are those synonyms? Could we kind of use them? And then he kind of says, like, the mindfulness is paying attention to the details, and the awareness is seeing the whole picture.
Right, and the space around.
The space around. The devil, you know, the devil may be in the details, but really you want to see the whole big thing.
Right. And so this relates to the fringe of our as he's talking about the fringe of emotions. So because we're expanding and we're noticing the space around, we actually can start to touch our emotions in a kind of the edge of our emotions. Does that make sense? Is there a connection there to people? So mindfulness is primarily the aspect of the technique that is being right on the spot, and awareness is feeling the environment around that mindfulness. Awareness is more panoramic. And then on the other page, 143, he talks about the connection with awareness and linking it to meditation practice in everyday life. So this is the bridge into our ordinary experience. So what I wrote in the paragraph, in the edge here, in the margin, what links meditation to everyday life? The answers on page 143. I wrote these little hints here. What links meditation to everyday life? Okay, read that sentence.
Yeah, the continuity of awareness links meditation practice with everyday life.
And what does that mean to people?
Being present.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And noticing, but really like noticing the big picture of what's going on. Not like today I was irritated with so and so, and yesterday I was irritated with that one, but like, Oh, every day I'd pick somebody to be irritated. That's what I like to do. That's what ego is having a good time with.
Yeah.
Who's bothering me today?
Right.
Seeing the whole pattern.
You're not just
looking at the little individual word. You're seeing the entire paragraph and the page and the chapter it's on.
Right.
So you grasp a bigger sense of space around it.
Right. And that's what's the link here into the emotions. So that comes up on the bottom of page 143. I think I'll back up a little. Connecting with the wholeness of the environment brings oneness with the action, making each activity more precise and direct. Then there's no room for ego's panic. You are able to cut the chaotic aspect of the thinking process because at that point you are completely joined with the situation, not separate from what is there. That enables you to step out of the complicated thought process. So that section is actually having more direct connection with what we're doing. And that is like a direct experience rather than, you're washing dishes and your mind's wandering. This is about this awareness being really present right with what you're doing. And that enables you to step out of this, wandering mind. So then the next paragraph is really where we get into the emotions. As this awareness expands, you also gain insight into your emotions. So that's where the link is here. This is, we have more awareness, but we also start seeing our emotions, like Elise was saying. To begin with, you may only be able to approach the fringe of your emotions, not yet the heart of them. However, you are already able to see the emotions much more as they are, with their dynamic qualities and their simplicity as well. You also see that there is more to the emotions than just the intense highlights, which is how we often experience the emotions, the intensity of it. You become aware of the larger emotional environment, realizing that the emotions have to function in a wider space. Anger and hatred come out of an environment of aggression. Passion and grasping come out of an environment of seduction. As you see this larger space, the emotions no longer have a cloudy, mysterious quality, but they are part of a living situation. Then eventually the emotions can be seen in their complete perfection, which is something we'll talk about more in the next chapter. Good thing we're going to cover that. That's a teaser. So any comments? I think this is a really amazing paragraph here in terms of this link to the emotions. So the awareness, we start to have a bigger view and we start to see more clearly the connection. Yes.
I was kind of just conceptualizing it all, just like thinking of you getting these gaps, these spots that clear your view of seeing the world where, when you don't have them, everything's kind of, it's like opaque and you can't see through it. So you're kind of poking holes to be able to, through meditation, to be mindful, to be able to see what is around you and what is, and what is there and also what's under the surface that's coming up too.
Mm-hmm.
Because it does poke those holes to allow those things to percolate up.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a good way to put it. Yeah, penetrating, starting to see through. Yes, Jim.
So I always had thought that Vipassana or insight meditation is walking around in everyday situations. And sitting meditation prepares you and trains you to be able to watch your thought and emotions walking around every day. So to use a tennis analogy, the sitting is like you're practicing against a backboard. And then the Vipassana is when you're out there and there's someone else firing while he's at it.
Well, Vipassana can also be a practice on the cushion. When you actually, we worked with this last summer. I don't think you were here that much. Yeah, because you were landscaping business is busy in the summer. But with raising your gaze and having a broader scope out, then there's actually working with the environment more than lowered eyes and working very much more tightly with the labeling as the thinking process. So it's actually a different technique. We actually taught it as a technique last summer. So we'll probably be doing that more. But I think I worked a little bit with you on that.
And is that just a different school or whatever the term is? Like Thai Buddhism, define Vipassana as maybe what I...
There's Vipassana. So if you go to the Insight Meditation Center, for instance, they use these words very differently. So you'll find it can be extremely confusing. They work with... It's a tighter system, the Vipassana. So my understanding is that it works more with sort of how things feel within your body, and it's a more inner system. When we use the word Vipassana, the way Trungpa Rinpoche used it, it was really about a broader awareness. So mixing your mind with space and looking out and just resting in the space.
But isn't he saying trying to find the seed or the root or the very beginning of emotions and thoughts and watching them at that point? Is that what he just said here?
Yes, I think that's part of it too. But basically in this chapter what's being emphasized is awareness in everyday life. And that, well, it's also, I mean, I guess it would be applied as well in terms of on the cushion, because we're talking about seeing things arise in terms of the emotions and having space around them. So it's both. I don't think it has to be separated out that way. Any comments there, Michael?
Well, he actually talks about a mix of, because you're, the Vipassana is a broader context in which these kinds of experiences can be seen and related with. And so one of the things you mentioned was the accuracy or the amount of accuracy and specific, dealing with a specific situation at hand. One of the definitions he uses for mindfulness is totally being at one with what you're doing.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, you're not trying to hold an argument while you're trying to do something. You're really just there. It's all about being there. I think that's one of the aspects of it. Like you're being there with your full, complete presence. And that can only happen when you actually... We have to start that still on the cushion. We don't only reserve the Vipassana for off the cushion. We find a way to actually...
Practice it.
Yeah, we're actually bringing... And we're taking it with us when we're off the cushion as opposed to...
Yeah, I was always afraid if I, on the cushion, went down that road, I would just follow the...
Slide over to the... mindless wandering.
Like a dog on a scent or something. I'm doing Vipassana, but I'm really just following this and entertaining myself.
Yeah, so that would be what you have to work with is you're just in the present, you're just working with what's here. Right? But in Vipassana, it sort of happens spontaneously. It isn't like time to do Vipassana pushing a button. It occurs, and that's one of the things you talk about. Some teachers say, you have to do your Vipassana as a separate practice from your shamatha. But what we've learned through his teaching is that it can actually occur spontaneously. And so rather than thinking it's going to be something extra that comes in, it just actually occurs in the process of the natural development of your practice itself.
So the last thing I want to mention in this chapter is this idea of thoughts become transparent. I guess it's in two places, but I see it right now on page 144. That's where I am. It would be the second full paragraph. This approach is not cutting off the thought process altogether, but is loosening it up. Thoughts become transparent and loose, so that they can pass through or float around in our minds more easily. Thoughts are often very heavy and sticky, and they hang around, demanding that we pay attention to them. But with this approach, the thought process becomes relaxed and fluid, fundamentally transparent. How do thoughts become transparent or lighter? How does meditation...
They're not so solid, I think is what it is. I don't see transparent. To me, it's kind of like translucent.
Translucent.
I see you, but I can see through you.
That's transparent.
No, not
I think that's what he meant in this sense.
Okay, semantics. But anyway, yeah, that's what I think that means. What I liked, in addition to the first part that you brought up, but the best part for me was his bringing up impermanence, which really, to me, is like, oh, you know what? That's the key to all anxiety. That's the key to everything that threatens ego. The impermanence. And then, you know, you could cry reading that we like real flowers because they're impermanent, and we like the seasons because they're impermanent. And, you know, as you watch the seasons come, you know, it's going to go. And then, you know, you really appreciate something so much more fully that way.
Yeah.
And then, I guess getting back to what Roberta said, in a way that can help you fix certain things. So, I mean, you know, it's, and this too shall pass kind of thing. Really, if you really take that on, Pema Chodron talks about working in traffic jams a lot. Mm-hmm. You know, you really can get over your anger and your constant reaction to wanting to, you know, hating that driver, you can get over that. That can pass. Mm-hmm. You can do that. And in a way, there are these little parts of you that can be sort of, you would call it fixed. I don't know if you want to call it that, but that they can be taken care of by more openness and mindfulness, mm-hmm. and seeing that translucence.
Well, we do change.
So, I mean, I guess I'm saying it's, it's not so fixed that it's
not fixed.
I mean, hopeless sounds like, oh, it is hopeless. I mean, that to me is just as fixed a statement as saying, hold on to hope. Yeah.
Okay.
We are just saying that it's fixed. Nothing is fixed.
No.
The change is happening. The change will happen. We can't force it, and we can't even see that it's happening necessarily at any point. But over time, we are on a journey. We are changing. We are becoming more stable. We are becoming more even and less reactive. And all this is happening.
And that can happen.
It is happening.
It does happen.
And it's not only relating to painful things. It's relating with evenness to pleasurable things, too. That over the long run stabilizes us, mm-hmm. and makes us actually enlightened people.
Oh, yeah, the sense of hopelessness. No, I feel like when I admit that everything's hopeless, I can relax. Mm-hmm. I don't, you know. It's like, okay, it's hopeless anyway. So I'm going to fail. I'm going to be fucked up totally. So that's all right. I'll just do the best I can. And, you know.
Well, you're giving up on outcome, right, aren't you? So that's the point. Like, we can't say this is the outcome, or I'm meditating to get this. Forget it, you know. It's not going to work. It's just that we're just working with the process, and we're willing to go through the process and see what transformation happens. I mean, changes will happen. We don't know what, So it's not about so much hope and fear as it is about the courage to actually do the practice and work with our minds.
Yes, I think of the work I do too. You know, these homeless people are drug addicts, and they're, you know, 90%+ of them are not going to attain sobriety, probably. You know, that's not going to happen. They'll sober up for a while, and then everybody falls off the wagon, and it's, you know, overdosing. It's just you can't, you know, your goals are like,
right, little step.
Little something once in a while, and not, you know, never necessarily a permanent improvement.
And well, you have to give up your expectations about what you think should happen or how they should be.
Yeah. I mean, if people could behave civilly and not try to kill each other at the center, this would be good.
Well, let's move on to the heart of emotions. So this chapter, we're going deeper, and the starting point is Maitri. Does anyone remember what Maitri is?
Loving
kindness
to
oneself. Starting with yourself, yes, loving kindness. Starting point is Maitri. So, let's see. There's one thing I want to point out throughout this, and I just used my pencil and made a little box around every time I saw this. And this is the phrase, as it is, or as they are. Did people notice that over and over in this chapter? So let me read the first couple sentences, and that comes up there. There is no such thing as an ideal state of meditation. Awareness allows us to relate to our mental processes and to see the fundamental expression of mind as it is, including our thoughts. The meditator may find that many thoughts recur during the meditative state. These thoughts should be seen as waves on the ocean. They are a part of our intelligence. When they aren't armed or heavy-handed anymore, they have a transparent quality. Thoughts also develop an evenness when we recognize that, fundamentally, nobody is trying to fight against anything. So here, often we think we're trying to get rid of our thoughts. And I know that it feels like when the barrage of thoughts comes, it feels like we want to just have some peace. Isn't that what this is all about? Shamatha, peaceful abiding, I must be doing it wrong. No, actually, our thoughts are what we have to work with. And that is actually the juice of what we've got. So awareness allows us to relate to our mental processes and to see the fundamental expression of mind as it is. So everyone sits on the cushion and looks still, or somewhat still, but we think everybody else must have, you know, they're just resting in this quiet state of shamatha. Well, you look at your own mind and you know what's happening. Well, everybody else is going to do the same thing. So this is our starting point. And so it says, from this experience we learn a different way of looking at life. Life is no longer warfare. So we're starting to see seeing the transparent quality of things as they are brings us into a new dimension of life. It also brings an absence of aggression and speed, so that finally we are able to fully enter into the territory of our emotions, both in their conflicted and in their pure state. So just by doing the practice, we start to accept what's going on, that we have thoughts, and that these waves of thoughts are part of the process. So we accept what's happening as it is. And by working with the thoughts and letting them go, that actually opens up space. And this is the transparent quality starts to come through, because We know the thought. We don't. We just don't believe in them anymore. We don't believe in the thoughts that they're so solid. And because of that, it lightens up, and this is the transparent quality that starts to come through. So the beginning and the starting point in this chapter is about Maitri. So being friendly to ourselves, being friendly to our process, it's difficult to look, but being willing to look and be with whatever occurs and comes up. That's where we begin. And then from that, the quality of this unconditional compassion. So this compassion naturally arises from that space because we're actually allowing things to be as it is and relaxing with what's actually happening rather than trying to follow some ideal and trying to shoehorn into something. And with that comes compassion and warmth and spaciousness. We don't have to push ourselves into extreme situations anymore because we contain a spacious situation within ourselves. I think that's pretty neat.
There were a sentence just before you started reading was one that sort of struck me here.
Yes.
Often we think of compassion in terms of feeling sorry for someone or thinking that we are in a superior position to someone who needs our help. Here we are speaking of basic fundamental compassion. And those sentences were actually very helpful for me because I was sort of, I realized that perhaps one of the problems I was having with the word compassion was thinking of it in sort of like a charitable gesture.
Mm-hmm.
And sort of saying what it isn't in this case was very useful for me.
Good, good. That's very important. And it's very important to know that. So we're not coming at compassion like being superior to helping somebody else who, you know, is missing something.
Yeah.
But we actually connect with our own situation first. And then we realize, just like me, that person, mm-hmm. you know, they're mad because, you know, they're having a bad day because, or you can really have compassion because you've gone through it. You go through it yourself. So I wanted to move over to page 159, the essence of the emotions.
149.
Oh, sorry, 149. So now we're getting into the heart of emotions. And what he says here is that the essence of the emotions is primordial wakefulness. Okay. What do you think of that? Okay. Well, we have some comments from down there.
No comment. I don't get it. Went right over my head.
Okay.
They're sort of that they're not something to be just dismissed, and then you know that it's not just something to throw away as unevolved.
Okay,
that's the way I interpreted that. But I'm not sure. Yeah, I don't think from a.
I had a question on page 148 where he talks about you know, not getting into using the anger and not suppressing it. And there's a sense, he says, there's another way, which is to actually relate to the bubble of energy that arises.
So
and
this, yeah, go ahead.
That sounded really important, and I emailed Eric and I said, what does that look like? Like,
so
what is that something you do on the cushion? Is that something you do in your everyday life? Is it?
So this is about the emotion having pure energy. That there's energy within the emotion. And usually we right away attach a story to it and we miss the powerful energy that's in there, which is actually, you could say, harmless. You know, if it's without a story, it's just pure raw energy. It's when we attach a story, which then
right.
means me and other, and we stress this duality, that it starts to, you know, take on much greater proportions. But the energy is pure in itself. It's awake energy.
But how do we contact that? So that's, I was like, I yesterday I sat down to meditate, and I had all this kind of, and like, very strong emotions going on about stuff in my life that I had a lot to do, and I didn't know if I could get it done, and it mattered, you know, all those kind of things. And it was very intense, and I was trying to think, like, do I do something on the cushion to notice that it's just some kind of, like, is there something I do to notice that it's just energy, or is that not what he's saying? I just wasn't sure.
Is he talking about investigation?
Yeah, I wasn't sure, or letting go of the stuff. And I was trying to just notice, but I still didn't know what that meant, because I don't have that good sense of, like, you know, he says it's just energy, but that would be like if somebody said, you know, the inside of a baseball is just twine, and I didn't know what twine was. Like, how do I know that?
What is it that you would drop away to experience the energy?
I'm not sure, because I...
So there's something, there's a story around it, right?
A story. Right.
It's the story.
Story, any images that come up, anything that's intellectual, really, around
the
it.
The concept.
Just be in that energy, that feeling. And even I would say, when I noticed one time when I felt angry, when I let go of the word anger, I was able to tap into some this energy that was very strong.
Mm-hmm.
But it when I let go of the anger aspect of it, it became this really great energy.
Yeah.
It's not. Mm-hmm. It's rare to be able to do that.
Right. Well,
but
it is.
But when I do accomplish that, it's pretty impressive. What? Because anger really is just energy to get you to do something. But even just sitting with that,
well,
not doing
the anger
anything,
gets triggered by something too, and so the trigger is an object, and so that's, you know, if it's an irritation that's kicking you off and getting you exercised, you know. We learn how to drop the object.
Right.
We're learning how to let the energy rest in itself. And in resting in itself, we can actually experience it completely openly without worrying about it going crazy or doing something ridiculous, you know. Letting it rest in its own place. This is where we use our shamatha practice of just letting everything settle into itself.
Megan had a very important point which has to be acknowledged.
Okay.
Okay.
What did she say?
Well, why don't you say what?
Okay. You said that it has its purpose.
Mm.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. You said
what? Anger has a purpose in getting you to do something.
Mm.
And passion has a purpose in getting you to do something.
Yeah.
So these things are not just nuisances, nor are they... simply things to be I don't know what,
classified, dismissed.
Yeah, in other words, in a greater environment, all these are tools that move us through our life in useful ways.
Right.
All our emotions have utility, and that's I don't think it's said enough here, but it's an essential point.
That's a really good point, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But I also just think, you know, I have to say also that you, at the same time, have to be aware that you're just not reacting, you're just not just being reactive to your anger. I mean, they have you, they're sending you important, emotions send us important information, or delivering important information. It does not mean that we have to act on that
emotion.
Information blindly. I just wanted to.
Mm-hmm.
And still, they have utility.
Mm-hmm. Sure,
it is. Also, like you when you need it has utility, but then you just don't want to get stuck on it when it doesn't have utility anymore. Is that the point? So
well, that's part of it. Yeah, I mean, utility doesn't mean that we cook it up when we want to get something done. Okay, it has to be much more spontaneous and released than that. Like the image you're going to get to.
Oh, which is that?
That's snake.
What's that?
That's snake.
Oh, why don't you explain that?
I don't have a book.
Here, you can look at it.
Where's the snake?
The snake. Okay.
First paragraph on 149.
Can I just add to that?
What?
Can I add to that about the emotions and
yeah.
The energy of emotion? Because my experience of this is that If I take a look at what has worked me up, whatever the trigger was or the reaction, I usually can notice that I'm either, this is something I don't want, mm-hmm. so I'm pushing it away, yeah. or it's something I really am often embarrassed that I want, right? So it's, again, going back to the skandhas, right? Because if I can just step back and say, well, maybe it's fine, right? Then it changes it into something that isn't after me, isn't going to eat me up, it'll be okay.
Well, that sounds like layering on something. It'll be okay. I don't know about.
Well, then.
Because what about the real energy that's underneath that? I mean, maybe you do feel hurt, or maybe you do feel something, but is there a way of actually just feeling or being with the energy of that and dropping everything, the story around it?
Yeah. I think so, because I don't think I'm trying to just put it aside.
Right.
And the times when I've been able to do this, I just pay attention to it and breathe.
Mm-hmm.
And that changes it.
Oh, that's what you meant by it would be all right.
Yeah.
It's not a coating over.
That's right. That's not a different story I'm telling myself. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I don't think it's easy.
No!
I think to assume that resting with all that energy, it's, you know, as it manifests physically, you know, emotions.
It's hard. It's very hard to ride it or sit with it.
Yeah.
To actually, make it useful. I just find that, I mean, I'm more likely to sit there and feel like I'm just going to have a heart attack.
Right.
You know, it feels like, okay, what the hell do we do with this? You know, I try to drop the story, and then there's this, yeah.
But that's it. What the hell do we do with this?
That's it.
There's no answer.
There's no escape either.
Yes, Jim.
Right.
It doesn't seem useful to.
Well, don't worry about that.
That would assume you already know what it is, instead of, this is an immediate, sudden eruption of something, and it's very fresh,
mm-hmm.
and that's where the power is. It's not because, oh, here this thing comes again, I know all about it. I don't know about it. I mean, this is where the potency is actually in this complete, willingness to just be open and actually be with it. So that at that point, you're not trying to get rid of it, but you're willing to, on some level, honor it. Honor your experience, honor the moment as it is, so that actually, whatever it is, I'm here with it, and we're going to be able, and we're just going to work together. I mean, we're working together. I'm working together right now with being here.
It's like working out. You're actually working out on a certain level, and it will only be later, when you encounter the rest of your life, some place along, you find that something has been awakened or strengthened, or you're actually
something old rather than something new. I mean, it's usually like my second ex-husband, which I've done, something after my brother when he was five or something, something ridiculous.
Do you sometimes start laughing? Because sometimes I just
look
at still stories,
How's that book, the humor? And some people said they didn't get that. But
sorry,
it was several weeks back, and I don't remember if it was this book or the... No, probably it was the
book.
Book. Tell me about seeing the humor.
Oh, it might have been in the...
You had that really good comment about the Russians. They would have this...
When you discover you're arguing with dead people,
that's an example.
Yes. So we're getting towards the end, and there's an image here which has to do with the snake. And Michael's going to say something about the snake.
You can find the passage.
It's
149.
149. Where is it on 149?
The first full paragraph, the second to last sentence.
Here's the snake right there. There's there, and then the next page to the beginning.
The essence of emotions is primordial wakefulness. That's a very powerful way of looking at them. We might think of mind as wakeful, as containing wakeful intelligence, but not the emotions, because we distrust them. Mm-hmm. We often see them as something overpowering, unnecessary, or dreadful, something that we should cast off or find some way of getting rid of. Mm-hmm. But in fact, the basic nature of the emotions is that they are awake in themselves. They are like a snake curled to strike that unwinds itself in mid-air. That is the transcendental quality of the emotions. When we trust ourselves and we really enter into the emotions completely. That's used.
Yeah,
also,
and then
in the
it's
very
right
last
here.
Yeah.
This is how it's made. The next page on page 150 at the top. It comes in again.
Okay. Well, sometimes you can only touch the fringe of an emotion or an experience, which might mean that something is threatening and you're trying to keep it at a distance. At that point, try to regard the fringe as also being right at the center. If the fringe becomes the center and the center becomes the fringe, there is no conflict between the two at all. Hard to understand. There is no conflict within you or within your experience at that point. That is how the snake unwinds itself in midair. The emotions free themselves rather than you're trying to find a way to alter or destroy them.
So when the snake is curled, it's like how we feel tied up in the emotion. The whole thing is tied up. And this is a traditional image where you throw the snake in the air and it can't hold its coil. It just releases. So that has to do with feeling like we get tied up in knots over the emotions, and then there's just this, when the self isn't in the center of the coil, the whole thing can just unravel. So it's the ego and strengthening the ego that holds the whole thing together. But when we can let go of the ego and are, you know, they did this to me or I'm mad because of that, then the whole thing just opens. And it's like throwing the snake up in the air. It can't hold the center anymore. And we let go of the center of me, and the whole thing just dissolves. It just falls apart. So that's the letting go process, and the heart of the emotions is this willingness to give up our self-cherishing and seeing it my way, and that fixation. So that's really fundamentally the liberation that's being talked about here, is just letting that go, and that opening and relaxation. That's really what we're talking about, this primordial wisdom of the energy of the emotions. It's a very, I have to say, it's a very advanced concept. Yeah. I wouldn't say, you step in here and you go, oh, that sounds great, I'm going to do that. It sounds wonderful.
But just to
it's
go
not
further,
quite like
we're
that.
Not actually throwing the snake after the air. The snake uncoils itself easily, effortlessly. The snake doesn't have to worry about untying itself. You know, it knows how to uncoil.
But does it have to strike?
Well, that's what I think. Well,
when there's nothing there to create an object for it to strike.
Ah,
which is basically
okay.
Letting things rest in themselves.
Ah, I see.
And actually, when we're actually investigating to see whether there's any self in the first place, any me,
right.
Where is this I? Where is the thought? Where is the object? Where is the subject? You know, as we simply continue to explore, this is what we're talking about,
Vipassana
as an investigative technique,
yeah.
Then the situation itself becomes self-clarifying. In other words, it just releases on its own. And it doesn't mean that there isn't that nakedness in the moment of the intensity, which of course is not going to last. It's not like I'm going to be able to carry this around all day, but it's very potent. And
yeah.
So we don't try to turn it into anything, put it in our pocket, sustain it, but just actually open to it, and that is actually an experience of awareness.
And we don't suppress it, and we don't express it. We don't, you know, so it's just sitting with that raw energy of it. But that's very helpful, because I had a lot of trouble with the snake.
And is Michael,
it sounds like a poisonous snake.
Yeah, that's what I thought.
You know, I know I'm, you know, if I, you know, properly had no ego, I wouldn't be worried about being bit by a snake.
But if, yeah. Well, but if you think that it's scary. Just an animal, that that's how the snake gets its food, and yeah. is productive. Like, it can't keep going. So if there's energy there, then you just, that's how it has energy.
I have a question. Yeah. You know how there's a phrase, form is emptiness, emptiness is mm-hmm. form? Okay. I'm wondering, a little lower in the middle of page 150, when it's talking about whenever there is space, space is the center in itself, as well as the fringe in itself, because there is no way to divide space into pieces. And that realization breaks down the barrier of duality of me and my projections completely. There's no solid wall between us and our projections anymore. That made me think of that form is emptiness, emptiness is form. Am I...
From the heart.
Well said.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Well said. Yeah.
Very
good.
So I think we have to end. Sorry about that. But there'll be one more class here on this book. And so for next week, if you could read A Mindful Society, chapter 22. And you might want to take a look at the editor's afterword. I found some amazing things in there that it's pretty interesting, actually, if you want to read that part. So we'll have one more class, kind of a wrap-up. And then the following week, we're going to have a fantastic movie. So a little change of pace here. So thank you all for your participation. Did you have a question?
Well, I'm just wondering what after that are you...
Oh, yes.
Do you know?
Yeah, you can turn it off. After that, we're going to go into the Mahayana teachings, and we're going to study the paramitas. So there are six paramitas. We're going to work with the paramitas, and there will be more about that time. We're going to be talking to... of the mm-hmm. profound treasury of the ocean of Dharma. Mm-hmm. Profound treasury of the ocean of Dharma. So that will be on the web.
I just have that by Chogyam Trungpa.
By Chogyam Trungpa Rinpoche. So I was trying to find a good text for that material, for the paramitas, and I kept struggling, so Michael Fagan said, well, why don't we just use volume 2? And I was like, okay, because... otherwise, I'd have to type them.
We'll be able to use it for other things.
And we're going to use it for a lot of other things. Because it's really a good volume of Mahayana. So I feel like it's really good to move more into Mahayana teachings at this point. It feels like expanding into working with compassion and kind of a wider scope. So that will be the next module. So that's a heads up, and this is what's coming.